Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast. Welcome to Volume 90 in the Brecan What's On information sessions, a series of talks produced for people with a gynecological or breast cancer, their families and friends. This session was recorded on the 11th of July 2013 at the Brecan Resource Centre, located in Melbourne's CBD. A level of distress or anxiety after a cancer diagnosis is not unexpected, but if not managed may lead to an anxiety disorder. In this session, Jane Fletcher, a health psychologist and director of the Melbourne Psycho-Oncology Service at Kubrini Health, discusses a range of anxiety disorders and their impact, as well as some simple strategies to keep anxiety under control. We hope you enjoy this session.
Okay, so welcome everyone. My name's Jane Fletcher and I am a health psychologist and a psycho-oncologist. So my specialisation is oncology and palliative care, and I have a particular interest in breast and gynecological cancers, and I'm a long-standing friend of Brecan and have been on the advisory council for some years. And my mother had breast cancer seven years ago, and mum came to Brecan for support, and Brecan has been a wonderful support to my mum through her breast cancer experience. And I think we've got a wonderful resource, and I thank you very much for coming today. But my task today is to talk about anxiety. I will probably talk a little bit in breast cancer terms, and I'll try and talk in general cancer terms though, because I know we may have some ladies here with gynecological cancer as well. But please don't be offended if I do just talk about, accidentally drop breast in. It's interesting, isn't it, when we actually think about it, that there's a lot of physical stuff here, isn't there, that how anxiety shows itself. We haven't really spoken much about what happens with perhaps the feelings of panic or the feelings of impending doom. It's really the physical stuff when we're feeling anxious that tends to dominate us, isn't it? And it's actually quite interesting for me, because that's actually what we can best work with when someone's very anxious, is actually what's happening in the body, because we can get you to do some work with how that feels. And it's really important, I'll get my little driver here, to actually go back now and actually talk about, well, we know what some of the, how it sort of affects us, what some of the issues that might drive the anxiety. We know how it presents in the body, but perhaps we now need to know the why this happens. And some of you might already know that, but I'm going to talk a little bit about that too, if I can get this to advance. Okay. And I guess I've used some pictures here to talk about what anxiety is about. So we know that it's about sort of that fear response. Sorry. I'm sure that will still work. I'm sure I'm still connected. So that should be working now?
No.
Okay. That's right. So you might just need, someone might just need to stand and advance the slides for me. Yep. So sometimes anxiety can feel like we're trapped, can't it? It can feel like we're in a bit of a prison. If you could go to the next one. Thanks. And I think Edward Munch, his paintings really do describe that choking feeling of anxiety, how sometimes we can feel that we can't breathe even. The next one. Now, Edward Munch is an interesting painter because he actually had an anxiety disorder himself. He also had depression, and he painted a lot about what happened to him internally and what it actually felt like. And this is one of his classic paintings, The Scream, and it really does talk about that panic that people might experience. So that overwhelming sense of anxiety where we might want to run away. Has anyone had that experience where you just wanted to leave, just wanted to flee? Yeah. Really powerful emotion. The next one, thank you. And then we've got perhaps what it feels like when we experience anxiety, when we're given a shock, a sudden event happens that causes us to have an anxiety response. And we I've often felt like the dog with the little black ears, haven't we, at some times? I know I certainly have. You know, someone yells at you, or you almost step in front of a car, or something happens and it causes a response that is incredibly powerful for us. And there's a physical and a psychological response. Next slide, please. Thank you. You're doing a wonderful job. So anxiety itself is an emotional state that's associated with that fight and flight response, and that's what that dog was doing. That was our fight and flight response, and you've all probably heard of that fight and flight response. Next one, please. And I guess it is that wanting to fight or wanting to flee. There's also what we call the freeze response, which sometimes happens too, where we become immobilised by our anxiety and we can't do anything, we don't know what to do. And for many of you, that's a little bit of what you would have experienced when you were diagnosed. So as soon as they said those words, you have cancer, often people feel that they just shut down and they don't know what to do. They can't move. They feel immobilised. Many people want to flee as well. They want to run away. Okay. And I am aware that some of this might bring up some emotion for you. Okay. So if it does, I'm going to be around afterwards and we can talk about that too. Next one, please. So it's important to understand what actually happens. So our brain, a little tiny, tiny, tiny structure in our brain, deep within our brain, called the amygdala. It's got a lovely name. I quite like saying it, actually, the amygdala. It is where our fear response is stored. And our fear response is a learned response. We learn to be afraid, don't we? Little kids aren't afraid, are they? They bound around and they jump off things and they do things without any care or concern because they haven't yet learned through life experience, giving them a few kicks, to be afraid, to have a fear response. But we have as adults. And therefore we perceive something to be a threat to our survival. The amygdala says, okay, let's now release a huge amount of chemicals into our brain. So the brain alerts the body and the body then reacts with these physical and emotional symptoms. And that's the anxiety response, pretty much summarised. Next one, please. There we go. And this is what happens in the body. So there's a whole range of responses that happen. And we have... we just go backwards. Next one, back. Next one. That's the one. That's perfect. Lovely. We've got it to work. Wonderful round of applause there for persistence and for just provoking just a little bit of anxiety. There we go. And that's the important thing to remember, isn't it? A little bit of anxiety is good. It gets me up here. It gets me performing in front of you to give this talk. But too much, and that's not good. But this is what happens in the body, and it's important to remember what happens. So we have an increased flow of saliva in our mouth. Our pupils dilate because we're alert now. We're hyper-aroused, physiologically aroused, ready for action to either or to flee. Our skin, our blood vessels constrict, and we might experience chills and sweating, and they do that because all of the blood flow now needs to go to these big muscles in the legs, because if we're going to run, we want these to be activated. We want these to be activated if we're going to defend ourselves. And this is all simple physiology and our survival mechanism. We start to breathe more deeply because we're trying to get oxygenated blood to the muscles, the big muscles, and our heart starts to beat faster while we get that palpitation feeling because our heart is trying to pump oxygenated blood to where it needs to go to. And something really interesting happens in our stomach and in our bowel. There is a decrease in the output of our digestive enzymes. It is too late now for us to get energy from food. Energy is released from other areas in the body, particularly from the liver, from our energy stores. So we stop the digesting food. Hence why we tend to feel sick. Because if you've just eaten a big meal, let's say that might weigh a kilo. If you were to vomit that up, you have less weight and you can run faster. And if you have a tiger on your tail, every gram that you have extra weight on your body counts at that point. So this is survival mechanism stuff. It's why when we're under extreme threat, we evacuate our bowel, we evacuate our bladder, and we vomit. And any of you who've had a very, very stressful experience will have had that urge to go to the toilet, yes? Or that urge to be sick. And that is your survival mechanism, and that's why you do it, because you're lightening the load to run faster. The same with the bowel. It shuts down. There's no now movement. It slows down, and you might want to evacuate the bowel to make the load lighter out of the small bowel. So it's all very interesting what actually happens and why it happens. But I guess for me, from as a psychologist, from a psychological point of view, it's all about the trigger and then the thought, the cognition that happens, that we perceive something as a stressful life event, that we think that this is a threat to our survival. Then we have a range of physical symptoms, and then we have a behaviour that we might do. Now that behaviour could be anything from running away or talking really quickly, or it could be some really negative behaviours like going inwards or becoming isolated. So biting nails, hair pulling, all of those are anxiety responses. Scratching at skin, things like that are anxiety responses. And also some of the other psychological issues that we will talk about as we move through. So, anxiety is a psychological state. Arousal is the physiological state. So that's the cataclysmic explosion of chemicals in our body, and then what happens here is the physical stuff. But then we experience that as an emotional state called anxiety. And is experienced when the optimum level of stimulation or arousal is exceeded. From the sports psychology, the performance area, we talk about the inverted U curve, where as anxiety increases, performance increases, but when anxiety gets too high at the top of that curve, the U curve, it drops away and we start to not perform very well. So it's what we call an inverted U. So we need anxiety, I need anxiety to be here at my top of my peak performance, I'm doing really well, but when that drops away, then I'm not going to perform very well. What athletes want is to be in that what they call the zone and perform really well. So they want a little bit of anxiety. But our problem is when we have too much and we start to struggle. And it's about this little device here working a bit too well for us and perceiving things to be threats or overestimating the amount of threat or future focusing on what potentially could happen rather than what actually is happening now. Because whatever's happening to us right now, well, we need to be responding to that, because that would be foolish, wouldn't it, not to be responding, to be seeing a car coming towards you and just standing there and going, oh, I'm not going to perceive that to be a threat. That would be foolish. So we need to have an anxiety response for some things. But 2 weeks before you go for your next test, before you see your oncologist or your surgeon, feeling anxious for those 2 weeks, is that actually helpful for you? Not really. So that's where we need to start thinking about how do we do something about it. So it is a psychological state. It's categorised by bodily symptoms, somatic symptoms, emotional thoughts and behavioural components. And the qualities are apprehension, dread, distress and uneasiness. And some of it's good, as I said, helps me get up here to perform and do our best. But the problems are when we have too much. And then we might have persistent feelings of fear and worry. So those fears about uncertainty. And we may avoid situations. Like you may not want to go back to the hospital, or you may not want to go back to day oncology, or you may find that you no longer want to eat those little 4-point sandwiches that you had while you were having your chemotherapy. But it may also cause you to do what I call dissociate from the experience. And that's very much what would have happened when you had your diagnosis. Most of you, and I don't want anyone to put their hand up, but you will have remembered when they told you you had cancer, you probably don't remember much more of the consultation. Would I be right in saying that? That you sort of were not there, but not there, because you'd sort of vagued out. And that's what we call dissociation. And it's a protective mechanism. When your stress levels are too high, we dissociate. If you've got a tsunami coming towards you, you probably don't want to remember it very well. So you remember it in a very strange sequence of events that you're able to cope with, rather than the whole overwhelming situation. So it's protective, but sometimes it's not protective. estimates of how common is anxiety in cancer patients? Well, we think that about 25%, but more recent data is suggesting that maybe about a third will have what I will call an anxiety disorder. But everyone who's diagnosed with cancer experiences a level of anxiety, and I'd be worried if you didn't, because that might suggest that you'd shut down emotionally. So we need a little bit of it, because that's what we have that experience when we're under stress. It's increased in some groups and at certain time points, so at recurrence or people with advanced disease. And the last point is an important one. These guidelines were written in 2003, and I was involved in the writing of them. I would like to think that things have changed in 10 years, and I think they probably have. At that point, we recognised that it was very much under-diagnosed, under-identified, and then under-treated. I think things have changed a little bit, but I'd say a little bit. I would say not much, because many people aren't actually asked about anxiety. You're not asked about how you're going psychologically. So why does it happen? Well, it happens because you're living with uncertainty. You're on a roller coaster ride. Many people say to me, it's like a roller coaster, it's like a ride at a fairground, but I didn't buy a ticket and I can't get off and it doesn't seem to stop. It just keeps going on and on and on. Because you live with the uncertainty of the ups and downs of living with a cancer diagnosis, of living with keep on going back for medical checkups, of living with seeing something in the newspaper that brings you right back to the day that you were diagnosed. And it's a bit like walking on a bridge where you know some of the planks are a bit uncertain. Or moving down into the unknown. Or a little bit of a tightrope. And it can be very isolating, incredibly isolating for people. This is why BreCan's wonderful, because you're sitting with a group of women who've all had a similar experience. And so there's a shared understanding of that experience. And it can be very isolating with your family, because you can be so close to home but still feel very, very isolated, because they don't necessarily get it, they don't understand what you're anxious about, and they might say things like, oh, but you're all okay now, you have to put that behind you and forget about it. And you can't, of course you can't, it's part of who you are. And it can lead to people going inward, turning inward, and becoming perhaps depressed and demoralised. And anxiety can also cause issues in relationships, and that's a really important thing to remember. That if you have problems in your relationship and you're feeling anxious, then please do something about those problems in your relationship and get some professional help. And places like Relationships Australia are a wonderful place to go. And we all wear the mask of the I'm okay mask in front of our friends and family, and then stand in the shower and have a good cry. That's what we all do, is how we cope with our emotions, how we cope with anxiety. But I'm going to suggest there might be a better way. The other thing I want to know is, anyone here just wear one hat, just have one role in life? Anyone? Because I'm going to give you $50 if you put your hand up. Notice how I say that after. All of us have multiple roles, don't we? We have multiple hats that we wear. This increases the amount of pressure we're under, the amount of anxiety we might experience. Our emotional resource is not a never-ending pit. It's a limited tank of petrol, isn't it? And the more stuff that happens to us, the more hats we wear, the more resource we use up, the less resilience we have. I'll just keep pointing to the resources on the stand here. And therefore, the more likely we are to have an anxiety response to something that actually may not necessarily need an anxiety response, like someone not putting the empty milk container back in the fridge, or not putting the toilet roll, replacing the toilet roll, or simple things that tend to just cause us to get really upset and anxious or have that grinding feeling in our stomach. For you, these things, CAT scans, CT scans, MRIs, are incredibly anxiety provoking, aren't they? Your follow-up testing, ultrasounds, mammograms, whatever that might be, blood tests, whatever those tests might be, can cause a great deal of anxiety. For people with ovarian cancer, a number on a blood test becomes a definitive number that people hang on to with great fear, great anxiety about what that number means, about how they might be going with their disease. And then there's the financial implications. Everyone becomes anxious about money. Doesn't matter how much you've got, everyone worries about money. The more money we have, the more money we spend. Cost, the dollars, become a very anxiety-provoking stimulus for us. And then we have dignity, which can cause a great deal of anxiety. I believe in treating my patients with dignity. These are dignity-conserving gowns from America, and they cover your bottom. If you ever go to hospital and they don't give you two gowns, please ask for a second gown so you can wear it like a coat over the top of your... So no one deserves to have their bottom waving in the breeze. I'm not very popular with the administrators at Cabrini, as you can well imagine, because I'm boosting their laundry bill by saying that, but I'll say it every time because I think it's really important that we're reducing our anxiety, especially times when we're vulnerable, by treating people with dignity and respect. And again, dignity and respect. And anxiety is about the way we put the pieces of the puzzle together. It's about the thought story that we create about a fact. And sometimes there's a piece missing in our puzzle and we create it. And I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you a story about a girl called Claire. Now, Claire is on the way to the hospital. And I know straight away all of you have created a little image in your mind about Claire. Would I be right? Somehow what she looks like, why she's going to the hospital, maybe, you know, what she's driving or is she walking. You've all created an image in your mind. I'll add in another piece of information. Claire is concerned about the surgery today. And again, that changes or might modify your image, your story that you're creating. Then I add in something else and I say, Claire's main concern is that she has only booked the theatre for 2 hours. Now that information might change the story quite significantly for you. And then I might add in another piece of information that says Claire realises that none of this is her responsibility as the surgeon's receptionist. And the story changes yet again. So for many of you, the first thought would have been Claire's a patient, wouldn't it? On the way to the hospital. Then on the way to the hospital to have surgery. And then after that second piece of information, some of you might have thought, well, maybe she's the doctor now. Would I be right in thinking that? And then suddenly, with another piece of information, it changes again. What I gave you was a fact. Claire is on the way to the hospital. You created a story around a fact. With more information, that proved to be faulty. Your story proved to be incorrect. We make assumptions all the time. We fill in the gaps, and often we're wrong. How many times have you been looking forward to a party, and in your mind you've had it worked out exactly what was going to happen and who was going to say what to who, and this whole little story, and you get there, and it doesn't turn out like that at all. Something very different happens. So we have to be careful that in your own lives, in relation to your cancer experience, that you don't create a story. The story is you've had cancer or you have cancer or whatever the fact is. The rest of it is a story that you're creating. Always come back to what you know to be true, and that will reduce your anxiety, because it's your individual story that you create that actually causes a lot of the anxiety for us. Does that make sense? And it causes an awful lot of fear too. Fear about the future. Fear about what could happen, fear about recurrence. One of the biggest fears for people with cancer is fear of recurrence. I gave a talk last year for Breast Cancer Network Australia at their conference in Sydney, and they asked me to talk about the fear of recurrence and actually talk about, you know, strategies, but actually talk about what that's about. And it was, you know, incredibly interesting presenting that information to realise that it's the biggest fear that people experience. And sadness, we spoke about sadness, didn't we? That came up as one of the themes, one of the drivers is the sadness. And it would be remiss of me not to talk about death anxiety, not to talk about the fear that something terrible might happen to you. And there is a fantastic book by Irving Yalom that actually talks about death anxiety, okay? All of us, the motivation for us all is to avoid dying. That's why our biggest motivation in life. And there are some psychologists who will say that all of our fears relate to death anxiety. All of our fears, everything, our fear of the dark, something terrible could happen and I could die. There might be a monster under the bed and I could die. Our fear of going up in high places is that I could fall and I could die. So all of the fears that we have, if we break them down, fundamentally come back to survival. And that's why they ignite our fight and flight response, because they're about our survival. And I don't know if we're ever okay with our death anxiety, but sometimes we do need to look at it and find a place for it so that it's easier to think about what's happened to you, to make sense of it. Worry. So we recognise, if you didn't have a bit of anxiety, I'd be worried. So it's very important to think about distinguishing between those normal fears and the severe fears that we can classify as an anxiety disorder. And anxiety is also associated with increased levels of pain. It interferes with sleep. How many of you here sleep well every night? Are we doing a session on sleep? Have we done one on sleep? Okay. Yes, sleep is an incredibly difficult issue, and if you are feeling anxious, then your sleep is even more interrupted. Nausea and vomiting. So if you're anxious, that's worse. Everything is worse when we're anxious. Our pain is worse, our experience of physical symptoms, whatever they might be, is worse when we're anxious, and it reduces our quality of life. Many people are able to work with their anxiety by learning more, getting more adequate information, good information. But for some, especially if you've had anxiety before, you may have feelings of, it's okay, it's normally me that that happens to. Normally you might have feelings of anxiety that may become overwhelming. So if you've had an anxiety issue in the past, then it can reignite your anxiety now. Many people who haven't had anxiety before won't go on to experience an anxiety disorder associated with their cancer experience, but some people will. And there are some types of disorders, and I'll generally go through them. So we have a generalised anxiety disorder, which is these feelings of dread and apprehension all the time. It doesn't matter where you are. It's not necessarily associated with a threat. So it can be just walking down the road, nothing particularly is happening, and you start to feel anxious. And it becomes conditioned. That's what happens, is the response becomes conditioned, where you learn to be anxious all the time. So it's excessive worry about multiple issues which linger for 6 months, and that can then be classified as an anxiety, a generalised anxiety disorder. And we have panic disorder with agoraphobia, so avoidance of public places. So panic is a particular disorder. People have panic attacks, but they have an overwhelming sense of anxiety, and they can feel like they're having a heart attack. And many people initially will call an ambulance because they will think that they're having a heart attack, but they're not. So it's a sudden feeling of anxiety, and then it leads to panic. And it can lead to not wanting to go out in public places, not wanting to expose oneself to anything that might ignite that panic feeling. And that can become very debilitating. We can have obsessive compulsive disorders, so checking or ritualistic behaviour to reduce anxiety. And it can be with intrusive or anxious thoughts, fears of germs or fears of getting sick, and it can result in some ritualistic behaviours to prevent them from happening, like excessive hand washing. There's a fine line between being careful and becoming obsessed with something, and if someone has obsessive compulsive disorder, it actually interferes with their life. Many of us are what we might call control freaks, and we like to have things in a certain way. We have perhaps obsessive compulsive aspects to our personality, I certainly do, but I would not meet the criteria for that disorder, because that's the severe end. Everything is on a spectrum. You know, I like order. I like things to be symmetrical. Doesn't mean I've got obsessive compulsive disorder. It means I like things to be symmetrical. And post-traumatic stress. I mention this because it is actually important to mention it here. Some people will experience post-traumatic stress disorder because of their cancer diagnosis. We think probably between 3 and 9%. I've got a PhD student at the moment doing some research on this. trying to get a handle of this, but looking at it in women with ovarian cancer. And it is a very acute onset of symptoms, of flashbacks, of reliving the experience, of a heightened response, what we might call startle response. So if someone screams, you jump. Those sorts of things can mean that there's some post-traumatic issues. But we always say it's okay if it's not interfering with in your life and not stopping you from doing something. It's only ever an issue when it's interfering with your life and then becoming problematic for you. Because all of us are going to have a startle response because we've all had things happen to us. So all of us are going to, all of us might double check our car every now and again to make sure we've locked it. That's perfectly normal behaviour that we might do under stress. It doesn't mean we have disorder. But there is such a thing as cancer-related anxiety. And this is the reaction to the threat of cancer. And it can be increased, as I said, in certain situations, the time of diagnosis, treatment, follow-up to appointments. In prostate cancer, we have this thing that we call PSA-itis. So perhaps we should talk about mammography-itis, the fear of going to have your mammograms, your blood tests, to test for the next what that might be happening and to look at progression of disease if that's there. And it's very, very powerful, very strong. And I know many of you will also experience that while you're waiting for the test results. And if you have a good oncologist or a good surgeon, they will get you back as soon as possible after you've had that scan, or they'll ring you to tell you the results to actually stop you from being concerned or worrying. And the time of recurrence can be incredibly anxiety-provoking. A phobic reaction, so people who develop phobias, this is anxiety that may lead to avoidance or to full-blown panic. And there are a whole range of phobias. I certainly do not have this one. I do not have a fear of speaking in public. But some people find it very difficult to be in public, so they have that agoraphobia. Some people have fears of spiders. Some people have fears of snakes, fears of high places. Some people have fears of flying. Some people have fears of being in closed spaces. But what we know in a medical situation is some people go on to develop claustrophobia and have difficulty with MRI and CT scans. And if you do, then please tell someone about it. Don't suffer. Actually tell someone about it, because they'll actually give you just a little tablet before you go in just to relax you that will make it a lot easier for you. And then needle phobia. A very, very common one that people may develop or may already have pre their cancer experience. But it can develop as a result of your cancer experience because you've been sensory overloaded. You've had sensory overload in relation to having continual blood tests, continual cannulisation. It's why we often like to put ports in rather than, or PICC lines in rather than keep cannulising someone who might have a difficult time having a needle inserted. And I work a lot with needle phobias, and they're very treatable if you use the right sort of treatments for them. And anticipatory nausea is an interesting one. So we know that nausea, it can become a conditioned response where people often feel a level of nausea before they go into the hospital or before their chemotherapy, because it's been a conditioned response because of the chemotherapy itself. So it's learned, like where we ring a bell when we feed a dog, and every time then after that we ring the bell, the dog salivates because it thinks it's going to get food. And it happens to us all the time when we smell baked bread, doesn't it? Saliva starts to come in our mouth because we've conditioned ourselves that when we smell baked bread, we're often going to get some baked bread. It's how gambling works too. And the post-traumatic symptoms are very, very, very common. And they can relate to the disease and treatment, and also previous trauma. If any of you have had a big traumatic experience in the past, sometimes it can reignite that experience. And there can also be some things that also happen with disease itself that also can lead to increased anxiety. So some things about your levels of the different chemicals in your blood, your electrolytes, delirium, where perhaps people's brain chemistry becomes unbalanced and they might begin to see things that aren't there or hear things that aren't there. Infection can also cause anxiety. a seizure, and also people when they have very low oxygen levels can start to feel anxiety. So we have to remember that sometimes there's a physical explanation as well for anxiety. And sometimes there's a physical explanation for some of these things too. So it's important not to think that just because you're feeling sick, it means you are anxious. It could mean something else. Or just because your heart's pounding, it means I'm anxious. It could mean something else. So we always have to get the symptoms, the physical symptoms, checked out by a medical person to ensure that there isn't actually a physical explanation behind it. And that's actually very, very important. We also know that drugs can lead to anxiety. And some of these drugs you will have had with your cancer treatments. Some of you may still be taking some of these drugs. So, steroids. Dexamethasone. How many of you experienced anxiety while you were on dexamethasone or steroids? I know from my personal experience that you give me a higher dose of steroids and I will become manic. I won't just become anxious, I will become manic. And I remember one Christmas I've got a bit of a bad chest, and I remember being discharged from the hospital on high doses of steroids and getting fixated on a Christmas decorative cake plate and running everyone around Chadstone looking for the perfect Christmas decorative cake plate. Can I tell you how many times I've used this decorative cake plate? That year, and then it sat in the cupboard and caused lots of laughter in my family. Some of the immunosuppressants, which many of you may not be taking, but some of the older drugs for nausea, Finergan, Maxilon, Stemetol, can actually in some people increase anxiety. If it happened, you'd know about it because it happens fairly quickly and it's quite a significant response and people feel very, very anxious. They feel like they want to jump out of their skin sort of feeling. But for many people, they tolerate them very well. So what are the signs and symptoms? So we look at the psychological stuff. Well, firstly, there's worry, apprehension, fear, sadness, some of the things we spoke about here. People may be able to identify the focus or source. They may not. People may also find that they're crying, or they may find that they're going over things in their head, rumination, over and over and over and over something. You can't get rid of that thought, an intrusive negative thought. The inability to turn off, especially at night time. And I think this happens to a lot of people, doesn't it? Can't get rid of those thoughts at night time. And then there's some non-specific, the three floating anxiety, not quite sure what I'm feeling anxious about. And the physical symptoms that we spoke about some tremor, we spoke about the nausea, and we spoke about some of the other issues. But we know that it's rapid heart rate, rapid breathing, feeling a dry mouth, inability to sleep. Some people can't eat. They just can't eat, so they become very thin. And we've spoken about why all of this happens, so we know that. We know why it happens. It may happen from time to time, and it may increase over hours or days, and it may decrease quite quickly. And it may occur in response to a stressor, anticipation of a test, and it passes once the test is over. But it may also be persistent and last for a longer period of time. And that's typical of someone with an anxiety disorder or someone who has depression as well. And it's a reaction to a chronic stressor, so the fear of recurrence, or if you've got family or financial problems, where the stressor doesn't go away. So we have to recognise there are things where the stressor goes away when you're waiting for the results of your tests, and then there's times when the stressor just sits there, like the fear of the future. And it can be side effects of medications, of course. Panic attacks are when there's that acute anxiety, and people will have severe palpitations, perspirations, nausea. They will have a fear of a catastrophic event. I am going to die, is often what people say. And they ring an ambulance, of course. I would ring an ambulance if I felt like that too. An overwhelming feeling of impending doom. And it can last for several minutes, and it can be petrifying if it happens. So people are most likely to have anxiety are people who've had anxiety before, people who experience anxiety at the time of diagnosis. If you've got pain or you're isolated socially, if you have a cancer that can't be cured, if you have a history of physical or emotional trauma, cancer medications and treatments. So the types of treatments, what do we do? Because I know that's what you're all here to find out. It depends on how anxiety is affecting your life. For many people, You feel a bit anxious, but you can move forward, you can get through it. But sometimes you can't. We often have to treat the cause if possible. So if the anxiety is related to pain or nausea or another medical condition, then we need to look at how best we treat that, because that will reduce your anxiety. If it's a medication side effect, we have to look at that. But it all begins with adequate information. If they hadn't given you any information about your cancer, how anxious do you think you'd be? Do you think your anxiety would be less, or do you think it would be more? More, wouldn't it? So we know that adequate information helps to reduce anxiety. And I guess that's why I'm such a fan of places like Brecan, because it allows you to obtain information very easily, and it allows you to talk to people who've had a similar experience, which reduces your anxiety, doesn't it? So remember that adequate information and support reduces anxiety. And I stress adequate, accurate information. Communication with your oncologist being fundamental. Making sure you understand what they're saying. If you don't, ask questions. Take a question prompt sheet in, write the questions down so you can get information. And avoid Dr. Google. There are some very good sites. There's some excellent sites. But what happens when we type in breast cancer, vulval cancer, ovarian cancer, is we will end up with overwhelming information that isn't relevant to you at all, that's not actually relevant. So places like Brecan, places like Cancer Council Victoria are very good sources of information, the Better Health Channel. But you remember that that information is general information and not specific information. The only person who gives you specific information is your medical treating team. And if you don't ask them the questions, they can't answer them for you. And they are very happy to answer your questions. And if they don't, you need to keep asking them. Often what happens is when you ask questions, a question falls off the list. So you need to keep coming back to that question and say, every time I've come, I keep asking about my pain. And it seems to fall off the list, but I'd really like to spend today discussing my pain because it's really difficult for me. Now, no one can ignore talking about that, can they? Because you've actually come in with that specific issue. And avoiding saying when they go, how are you? And you go, oh, I'm fine. And you're not. And often they'll go, oh, okay, so, and just write out a script. But if you're not feeling fine, you need to tell them. And then, especially if it's an anxiety or psychological issue, you want to be referred to someone who can help you, someone like me. So you can talk about it. We know that medication can be a very useful treatment for anxiety. And it can be used on its own, but the preference is always that it is used in conjunction with the psychological strategies and therapies, or that the psychological is started first and we see how we go, because the psychological strategies are very effective. But the medications that we can use, there are the pharmacological medications that we can use. I wanted to talk about also the psychological and the non-drug therapies, and then spend a bit of time talking about lifestyle factors. So the drugs that we might use. There are three types. There's the anti-anxiety, anti-analytic medication, antipsychotic drugs, and then antidepressants that work on depression and anxiety. When we talk about anti-anxiety medications, we talk about the benzodiazepines, and many of you will know about this particular class of drugs. And there are very short-acting ones like Ativan that some of you would have had with your chemotherapy, might have had that. Some people might have had Valium, and that's a much longer-acting drug, will reduce anxiety for a longer time. There are big issues with benzodiazepines because they are very, very a drug of dependence, so people can become dependent on them. And we have to balance our fear in prescribing of people becoming addicted versus having good symptom control and good quality of life. And that's why the psychological strategies are so important. So these things are often used in the short term, and then you learn how to deal with your anxiety and you don't need to take the drugs anymore. Does that make sense? Then there are some antipsychotic medication that's used, haloperidol or Haldol, and it is used in low doses for anxiety, and especially if people have agitation or there's a tremor for them, then we can use that just to calm people down a little bit. We also can use some of the opioids like morphine, and it's often given at end of life to reduce anxiety. Antidepressants. So often patients who have depression and anxiety might be used. It's not used as an ad-needed basis. You're on that medication for the long term. Where a benzodiazepine, you might take half a tablet just to reduce your anxiety. If you're on antidepressants, they take 4 weeks to work because they build up the levels of the neurotransmitters, the brain soup, the chemicals in our brain, and that's how they work. And particularly the serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors are the ones that are used for anxiety. And very, very effective. And antidepressants aren't addictive. Don't get addicted to antidepressants. We wean you off of antidepressants because we don't want suddenly the brain chemistry to drop away. So that's why we reduce the dose. But it's not because you're addicted to them. It's because of the balance in the brain soup, the swath of chemicals that the brain sits in that help it to send the signals around. They're anti-anxiety pills, but I'm too afraid to take them. Psychological interventions, and these are probably the ones that I would going to focus the next 45 minutes or so on. They're provided by a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a social worker, counsellors or psychotherapists, and some GPs. If you're going to someone, please check their qualifications and experience in dealing with cancer patients. It is very, very frustrating for you to go and see someone as a mental health professional who doesn't have an understanding of cancer, and you then have to explain it to them. That is very frustrating for you. And I've had lots of patients who've been to see a generalist psychologist and then have come to me because the person hasn't understood their cancer experience and hasn't understood sometimes some of the background stuff, and that it might be medication related. So I think it's important that you find someone you connect with. That's the most important thing, isn't it? Close proximity is another very important facilitator. I get a lot of people who I get referrals for who live a long way away, and I actually will try and link them in with someone closer because I don't want them to travel. It's too hard. Absolutely, I agree. And that's why the GP can be an option. But with some counsellors and some psychotherapists, please check their qualifications and their credentialing. Make sure they belong to a professional body and that they have had some training. Because there are some fantastic counsellors and psychotherapists, absolutely brilliant ones. And then there are some people who are not so good. So you have to judge it for yourself. And going to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a social worker counsellor is a little bit like buying shoes. You have to try it on for size. Our individual style may not be the right style for everyone, but for some people it will work. And that's what I say. If I'm not the right person, let me know. We'll find someone else, because it is really important that the fit's right. There are a whole range of different things that we might do, but we always start with psychoeducation, making sure you've got enough information, making sure the person understands what's happening to them. Also, active problem solving. Sometimes anxiety is actually a problem that someone can't see a different way of solving that problem. And I come in with a fresh set of eyes. And often I can see things a bit more laterally just because I've been trained to do that. And then we have more of the therapies that we might use. Cognitive behavioural therapy, really getting into the thoughts. The thought story, that's what was a cognitive behavioural technique that I got you all to do, where you created a thought story and that turned out to be faulty with more information. We use supportive and existential psychotherapies, acceptance and commitment therapy, and I'll talk about that, and then mindfulness. How many of you are doing any sort of meditation? Couple. Okay, great. Keep doing it. And we're going to talk about it. Relaxation skills training. There is a CD out there, the Cancer Council's Relaxation CD. They're free. Please ring Cancer Council, get a copy, borrow the copy from here, burn it. Liz is very happy for you to do that. That's why she created it. We also look at some of the grounding or centering techniques, and I'm going to talk about those because they're your crisis intervention. And hypnosis is actually very good. in dealing with anxiety, but you want to see someone who is qualified in medical hypnosis, not just general hypnosis. So the people who've done a specialised course like me. Therapy is individual. It's going to differ from person to person because each of you come with a different problem, a different concern. And we all use a completely different set of skills and different set of techniques. And for me, skill building is incredibly important. I am very active in therapy because I want you to go away with skills that you can use at home. You have an hour with me. You have 23 other hours in the day to be doing excellent work. And if I don't give you homework, I'm not doing my job very well. But it's so important that we maintain your autonomy and we get you to have a management plan so that you know that when this happens, I do this. So when I start to feel anxious, I do this, so you know what to do, rather than we spend all a lot of time talking about what happened to you in the past and we don't actually give you any strategies for now or the future. So we have to look at two things, crisis intervention and then ongoing management for anxiety. And crisis intervention is incredibly important if you're having an anxiety attack or a panic attack, and it's going to teach you how to ground yourself, and we often ground ourselves with the breath. So, abdominal breathing, breath awareness, and counting the breath. And you might need a coach to do that, so you might need someone to help you to count. But I'm going to just get you very simply to do a little technique. And it is literally called an isometric exercise where we push and we release, push and release, and we time that with our breath. So we breathe in, doesn't matter, I've got sinus problems so I don't breathe a lot through my nose because it makes a whistling noise and none of you really want to hear that. It's not very pleasant. So in, notice how much longer the exhalation is, and the exhalation is the de-arousal response. The inhalation ignites our fight and flight response and the exhalation de-arouses us, so that reduces, brings those chemicals that bring down the fight and flight response. And it's much better if you close your eyes. So if you're willing, let's do three of them, okay, and let's see what happens, okay? So we're going to close our eyes and we're going to use our fingers and we're going to breathe in and push and release. Push and release. And push and release. How do you feel? Sedated. Did anyone feel more anxious than when they started doing it? No. Most people feel less anxious by doing that, don't they? And it's a very quick and easy technique to do. And if you ever go on a plane and you see someone pushing their fingers together and releasing, that's what they've been taught to overcome their fear of flying. So that's what they sit there and do. And you can do that under the table, in a lift, wherever you might have an anxiety-provoking experience. Because the more you associate this with the breath, the more you create a conditioned response to de-arouse you. Okay, so practice it. It's something you can do just sitting in a meeting sometimes when things are becoming a bit heated. You can do that very, very simply and easy, and it's a very, very quick and easy technique. Abdominal breathing and breath awareness. There is a fantastic app, and I don't like promoting things that you have to pay for, but this one you do. And it's called At Ease, and it's for iPhones. I'm not sure if it's on Android, but it is for iPhones. And it's $2.99, and there's three tracks on it, and they're all about the breath. And they're fantastic, absolutely fantastic. I listen to it every morning, so it's what I do every morning. But the breathing will ground you if you're starting to experience anxiety, and that little technique is a very powerful one. You can also do things like nasal breathing, but I can't do that because of my sinus issues. We used to talk about paper bags. We don't talk about paper bags much anymore because we recognise that that might not be the right thing to do. We're much better just to use the breath to ground us. But you can use something like a clock or a metronome to help ground you, to help reduce that anxiety response. And there's an app for a metronome if anyone's interested. There it is. And you can set that if you like, that sort of thing. very much it's about staying in the now. So it's avoiding what I'm going to call catastrophizing thoughts about the future. So it's bringing yourself back to the here and now. And it might be a visual distraction, imagining your special place, taking yourself, I'm standing on the mountain, I'm standing looking out at the particular mountain or over a lake or wherever I might want to be, and I'm imagining I'm there, and that's going to help bring your anxiety down. Sometimes we need to do cognitive things, like focus on everything in the room that begins with an L, or everything that's red, just so that you distract yourself from what's happening here. Counting backwards from 100. Even just having a sip of cold water or a stress ball. They're very powerful things that we can use just to reduce our anxiety. And that's why this works well as well, just on its own. Stress balls. And then we have some of the relaxation training that you might do. Meditation probably isn't under relaxation skills training, but I've popped it there. Progressive muscle relaxation as well, deep breathing and visual imagery. And that CD that the Cancer Council has a lot of those things. They have a companion CD that is a mindfulness meditation CD. And that's what I'd be suggesting that we're all doing, because that's actually going to help. Because mindfulness meditation has been shown, when we scan people's brains who are meditating, we can see some things happening there, and it's very exciting. And I like to talk about the science, because I think the science backs up what we say. We've known for a long time that people who meditated seem to be more relaxed. They seem to be able to ride the waves better, and they seem to be a bit sharper than everyone else. Would you agree with that? Yeah, there seemed to be something about them that was... they seem to be nicer people in some way. And we now know why. That little tiny structure that I spoke about before, the amygdala, the one I like saying a lot, and I do say it a lot, when we scan people's brains, when we do PET scans of people's brains, when a PET scan looks for increased blood flow, and that means that that area of the body is working harder. When we watch people's brains who are meditating, we see three really interesting things happen. The amygdala becomes hot, really bright red, which means increased blood flow to the amygdala. And if the amygdala is like the control tower of the brain, it is what it determines what we're going to take on as a threat and what we're going to let go through to the keeper. If the amygdala is not working well, it's like the gates are open. Stuff can come through. Stuff is going to come through, and we're going to react to it. So we're going to get upset over things that aren't really important, get stressed about things that aren't really important. Couldn't find a parking spot, and it's the end of the world? No. If the amygdala is working really well, you just look for another parking spot. So meditation helps with that. It helps for the amygdala to act like a closed gate, so the stuff bounces off. The other structure in the brain that becomes very active is the hippocampus. The hippocampus is close to the amygdala, looks a little bit like this. Probably really looks nothing like that, but that's sort of what it does look like. And it is the learning and memory centre of the brain. We all know about neuroplasticity. It's very popular in the media, and I think we might even have the book The Brain That Changes here. Maybe. Maybe not. But there might be some books on neuroplasticity. The concept is that if we're activating certain parts of our brain, then our brain will learn new pathways, new ways of thinking about things, new ways of dealing with our emotions. And we know that the hippocampus is where neuroplasticity starts, and that becomes very active as well. So we know that the brain is now plastic. We're able to learn new ways of processing, particularly our emotions. And this part of our brain, the frontal lobe, where our emotional storage centre, where all the emotion processing happens, is very hot as well. So we're learning new ways to process information, and we're learning new ways to be able to determine what's a threat and what's not. We can ride the waves better. So I now have the hard evidence why it works. And I would say to people often, if I could give you a pill, and I said, here's a pill, you take it, everything in your life will be easier. But all you have to do is sit for 15 minutes every morning and be still while this pill dissolves, because that's how it works, would you do it? And most people say to me, yes, I would. And I say, well, what stops you then from sitting quietly for 15 minutes every morning and just doing some meditation, because it's going to have the same effect, and it has no side effects, absolutely none. The only side effect is you feel good. You feel rested, you feel different. I meditate every morning, and I had lost my practice up until probably about 3 or 4 months ago. I'd stopped practicing, I didn't have time, life was too busy, and then I went on a meditation retreat because we'd been doing some advanced training. And it was the best thing I've ever done in years, was to go on this retreat. And I started meditating again, and I can now see how different my life is now than it was before, because I wasn't having a regular practice. I'd meditate with my patients when I'd teach them meditation, but I didn't have a regular practice that I did as soon as I wake up every morning. And that's the difference. It starts the day for you. If your amygdala is working really well right from the get-go, then nothing really gets to you. It doesn't matter if I'm running late. What's the worst thing that happens? My patients can't start without me. So it changes the way you start to think about things too. And that's why it's very powerful. And that's why I talk about it a lot and encourage people to give it a go. And the thing with meditation, it has no judgment attached to it. So how many people have tried it and thought, oh, I can't do this. I've got too many thoughts. My mind's too busy. Yeah? Has that happened? Well, that happens to me too every morning. I start to think about, now I wonder what I'll wear today, and is that clean or is that dirty? And then I think, oh, okay, bring my thoughts back. The Buddhists talk about if your mind wanders for 1,000 times, you bring your mind back 1,000 times. With no judgment, you just bring your mind back. And that's what I like about that At Ease app, because it is very non-judgmental. So, some meditation pictures, and also remembering just to breathe. That's the biggest thing you can do if you're feeling anxious, is just to breathe, because you just start to deactivate your arousal response. Running my own business has given me an ulcer, 2 heart attacks and 4 nervous breakdowns. I manufacture relaxation tapes. And dear old Snoopy, it never fails. My toes relax, my legs grow limp, my stomach is calm and my eyes are closed, and I'm just dozing off when it happens and my fur gets tense. Hypnosis, as I said, very, very useful for phobias and those conditioned response. So needle phobias, hypnosis works very well with that. And what I tend to practice now is more of a meld between hypnosis and meditation. So I don't know what you'd call that, but there's a particular Michael Yapko, who's an American famous hypnotherapist, very much practices the same thing now. And you won't do anything under hypnosis that you wouldn't normally do. So people who dance around like chickens and bark like dogs, they're the people who do that with a few drinks at a party anyway. So the ongoing management strategies, though, for anxiety are to look what is behind the anxiety. We have to also get you to reduce your anxiety, but we also need to get you to talk about what you're afraid of. And most of us don't want to talk about what we're afraid of. Most of us don't want to talk about the fact that we're afraid that we could die, and we leave people we love behind, and that's what drives our anxiety, or that the cancer could come back and I might have to have more treatment, and what would that be like? And all of those things are real fears, aren't they? It would be foolish of me to stand here and say, you have nothing to worry about, don't worry about that. That would be silly. They're real fears. But we do have to look at our fears, because all of the other techniques are short-term interventions. They're not long-term interventions of getting you comfortable with the situation that you find yourself in, the uncertainty that you now live with. And that's the talking stuff. That's the psychotherapy part. And it all starts with getting in touch with our thoughts, though, and recognising that our thoughts drive it. So our thought, now I'm really in danger, my heart starts pounding, something awful is going to happen, then I feel anxious, and it just goes in that circle. So we do start to unpack the thoughts, and we have to come back to the reality. We're all going to die. That's our reality. If you've had a cancer diagnosis, you just have more information than the average person walking down the street. But that drives your anxiety, that drives the fear, and that causes the physiological response. So we need to talk about it. Because we don't want to be anxiety girl, able to jump to the worst conclusion at a single bound. And that's why, while talking about it, I still pull you back to the now. What do you know to be true today? Because even if anyone in here is sitting here with advanced disease, today you're sitting here coming to a seminar. The rest is what could happen in the future. That's the story that's yet to unfold. And our challenge is to let it unfold, not to try and gallop away with it and try and keep up with these thoughts that aren't really true. They're something that could happen, they're not what's actually happening. So we always come back to what's happening right now. And that's what cognitive behavioural therapy is about. It's keeping you in the present moment. It's based on teaching you to problem solve and to think about how you might change your attitudes and move away from black and white thinking. It's also about relaxation training and guided imagery. And we're teaching you in some ways to be Wonder Woman. Not Superwoman, because she didn't exist. But Wonder Woman had these cuffs. And she could bounce bullets off with these cuffs. And with these cuffs, we need to bounce thoughts off. These become our thought protective cuffs and our the external stuff that comes in from other people. When you're walking down the street and someone starts to say, "Oh, hi, and how are you?" And you say, "Oh, yeah, no, I've had cancer and they say, "Oh yeah, my best friend's cousin's hairdresser had that and they died." And then you stand there thinking, "Oh, I feel like I've just been hit by a truck. How did they think that would be helpful?" If we've got our Wonder Woman cuffs up though, we're recognising, "Oh, they're crazy, they're a silly person, why would they say that?" And we walk away smiling rather than walking away feeling, "Oh my goodness, I could die." And it's just about changing the way we think about it. Because what people say is just a thought, isn't it? Because you could tell me I'm a banana. I do not suddenly change into a banana just because you say that. You're not that powerful. And our thoughts are not that powerful if we have a good relationship to them. If we allow them to run away with us, they will. So we need to be thought vigilant. Supportive psychotherapies and the existential therapy are actually about talking about the stuff, talking about the experience, validating the experience, letting you have an emotional response, which is good. And we do that by listening and encouraging. And they're the times that I stop talking. I'm not skill building, I'm listening. It also, we give information, but it's also about highlighting your individual strengths and encouraging you how you adapt and cope. Acceptance and commitment therapy is related to cognitive behavioural therapy, but it's getting you to accept what is out of your control and what you can take control of. And I don't have control of what happens to me in the future. No, I may be Wonder Woman, but I'm not psychic or don't have these special powers to do that. But I do have commitment to take control of what is in my control right now. And the biggest thing that's in my control right now is my thoughts. And that's what we try to do. We try to teach you psychological skills to deal with the painful thoughts and feelings, the mindfulness. We help to clarify what's actually important in your life so you can move towards leading a life that's full, rich, rather than a life that's filled with fear and dread. And then we have all these lovely lifestyle factors. There is no evidence there is some exercise evidence. There is some exercise about evidence and recurrence of breast cancer, but there is a lot of evidence about exercise improving the way we think and our mood. Because when we exercise, we release serotonin. And serotonin is a wonderful neurotransmitter. If you remember the drugs that I spoke about, the antidepressants, they were serotonin selective and reuptake inhibitors, and they worked on serotonin in our brain. And serotonin is released when we exercise. Endorphins and adrenaline are also released. That's why we feel good when we exercise. So exercise is important. But it doesn't have to be huffy-puffy running about. It can simply be walking, just getting out, yoga, whatever you choose to do. It can be something that you like doing. The more you like doing something, the more you will continue to do it. Someone said to me, "Jane, you have to go and run round Albert Park Lake." It wouldn't happen. Someone said to me, "Jane, there's a yoga class down the road." I'd be there in 5 minutes. Find something you like doing. The mindfulness exercises, wonderful segue into them, are incredibly useful because they give you an exercise but also a mindfulness practice. So yoga, Tai Chi and Qigong. And I think we've had some sessions here, haven't we? Yep. Yep. So some simple yoga exercises and Tai Chi, and sleep. For getting enough sleep, everything is easier. So we need to think about good sleep hygiene. No wonder you have insomnia lying there awake all night. Sometimes I lie awake worrying about insomnia. This is a really busy slide, but I will break it down for you. We need to create a sleep sanctuary. In your bedroom is for two things. It is for sleep and intimacy. It is not for wonderful little electronic devices that stimulate our brain. It is for relaxing. It is for having a dark, quiet bedroom with a comfortable bed. We're not too hot, we're not too cold. And I know some of you are having hot flushes, and that can be difficult. But avoid TVs, computers in the bedroom, and reading before you go to bed is an absolute no-no, because you are stimulating your brain. You want to be relaxing before you go to bed. And sleep CDs, incredibly useful. I don't know if you have any sleep CDs on your list. So there's literature on sleep. Sleep CDs are really useful. So getting into bed and putting a CD on rather than doing anything else. So that's what we do. We get into bed, we put a sleep CD on. Preparing for bed, going to bed at the same time every night, avoiding TV too far before bed. We get a hit of melatonin, which is the trigger for sleep, about 10:30, another one at 11:30, and we don't get any more. That's why people say, oh, I get my second wind about 12 o'clock. Well, of course you do, because you've got no more triggers for sleep. So that's why you can keep going. But getting to sleep requires us having routine. It requires us getting into the mood for sleep and having some things that we do before sleep. I recommend 30 minutes before bed you do a simple technique called the data dump. Side of the bedroom, you write down everything that's going on up here onto a little book, and then you put it in the drawer somewhere. You don't carry it around with you and take it in the bedroom. You do this outside of the bedroom. You're dumping everything that's going on onto paper and you're leaving it there. You can go back to it tomorrow, or you don't need to. You can just leave it there, go into the bedroom, listen to your sleep CD, get to sleep. If you wake, put the CD on again, get back to sleep. If you are having problems with sleep, then think about maybe going to see someone about it too, because they and just for the focus on sleep, and they will teach you strategies as well. Diet. There is no evidence about diet and mood, but there is some evidence about preservatives causing anxiety. There is some evidence about some people who metabolise sugars in different ways. So what I will always encourage is just a healthy diet. You know, fresh fruit and vegetables, following the healthy food guidelines. And a limiting and avoiding alcohol. Often we use this to relax us when we're feeling anxious. Oh, God, I have a drink. Well, it actually does the actual opposite for us physiologically, and it interferes significantly with our sleep cycles. And it dehydrates us, and it's not very good for us. So limit alcohol. I'm not a nana. I don't want you to not have a drink. I think, you know, your individual choice is important. But think about the most important thing in all of your lives is vitamin Q. And I know you've not heard of it, have you? The most important vitamin. And normally at this point, everyone's thinking, oh, I wish I had a pen and I'd write this down. You know, someone said this is really important. And you know what it's in? It's in the best chocolate you can buy. It's in nice dinners out. It's in lovely strolls along the beach with someone that you have a good relationship with. It's sitting down and talking with your friends. It's going to the movies. It's perhaps having a very nice glass of wine. It's the quality of life vitamin. And if we have a good quality of life, then our mental health is good as well. So, I'd like to just do a very short practice, just a couple of minutes. And I'd like to do a special place one. This is a very easy relaxation practice that you can all do. And just imagining your special place. And it could be any one of these places, or it could be that one, which is mine. So I just want you to imagine your special place, close your eyes, focus on your breathing, and you're just going to listen to my voice. If you don't want to close your eyes, perhaps just put your gaze to the floor, just a few feet away, head down, and just focus on your breathing. Just letting the breath relax you. Just imagining you're breathing in a sense of relaxation. and exhaling all the stress and tension of the day, breathing in a sense of relaxation and exhaling stress and tension, just letting go of all the stress, all the tension. Just imagine that it's running out of your fingertips, out of your toes, with every breath becoming just that little bit more relaxed. And just knowing that every breath is relaxing you, allowing you to become more peaceful, more relaxed. And just now taking yourself to that special place, just imagining that special place, wherever it might be, whatever's right for you, visualizing, if you can, trying to use your other senses to experience it, and really immersing yourself in that special place. Knowing that you can go back there at any time, any point in your day, just closing your eyes and taking yourself back to your special place. And when you're ready, just opening your eyes and returning yourself to the room, to this space, place and moment in time. Does everyone feel more relaxed? Now, can you imagine what it might be like if we did that for, say, 20 minutes, how relaxed you might feel? And that's an easy thing to do. I would always recommend guided rather than trying to do it yourself unless you've got a lot of experience. So the CDs are wonderful. And I'm open up to questions. I've gone through a lot of stuff. And I guess it's about building bridges too, isn't it? It's about building to somewhere. And anxiety is a good thing in small amounts. So we're never going to not have anxiety. We're always going to have a little bit. But when it's too much, we need to have strategies on what we're going to do about it. And I've given you some today, but probably the biggest one is also, if it's a problem for you, please go and get some professional help. There's lots of help available. Brecan have lists of people that you can connect with. And again, trying to work out the person, make sure they're right for you. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for the opportunity. Much appreciated.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan's podcasts or browse existing ones at our website, www.brecan.org.au.